Scott Aronson is a computer scientist and director of the Quantum Information Center at UT Austin. His work centers around quantum computers specifically and quantum mechanics in general. This is Scott Aronson. I'm Duncan Gammey. You're listening to Dunk Tank.
Well, let's see. There are a number of really interesting questions I'd like to ask you about, but just for people listening, because this is for a general audience, I'm going to ask you kind of a straightforward question just to start off and lay some groundwork here. Can you tell us, like, what is a quantum computer? I've heard it overhyped, people, you know, underhyping it. Why do we care about this?
A quantum computer is kind of the first kind of computer that's been proposed that would operate on principles that are sort of fundamentally different than the principles that were laid down by Alan Turing, you know, 80 years ago, and, you know, that have governed all of the computers that we've had in the world. I mean, everything from, you know, a supercomputer to your iPhone to an old-fashioned vacuum tube machine, right? Yeah. They all operate on, you know, the same rules, you know, the same rules of, you know, Boolean logic and so forth. You know, they differ in how fast they are and how much memory they have and how many parallel processors they have. But in some fundamental sense, you know, they can all simulate each other. And not only do that, but they can simulate each other in a way that's theoretically efficient. Like a problem that took only linear time, you know, that had only linear scaling of runtime, you know, with the problem size on one type of machine would also have linear scaling on another machine, right? It wouldn't have exponential scaling, right, or anything like that. And so, you know, there were certain problems that we think are exponentially hard. That is, any algorithm for them requires exponential scaling. And that's true no matter how computers improve, you know, as long as they're built on the same principle. Okay. A quantum computer is different because it actually exploits something different about the laws of physics, namely quantum mechanics, which, you know, in some sense is, you know, the most surprising thing that was ever discovered about physics, or a candidate for that, almost 100 years ago. And I don't know how much you want me to go into this and how much time.
Sure. Why do you say quantum mechanics is perhaps the most interesting thing discovered about physics?
Because it's not changing this or that detail of, like, you know, what is the world made of, you know, like, what are the particles like, or, you know, how do they move around? It's changing the way that you have to calculate the probability that something happens, right? So it's changing a level of reality that you might have thought was not even physics, that was just pure math, right? Yeah. That was, I like to call it an operating system that the rest of physics runs on as application program, right? It's barely even physics, right? So the canonical quantum experiment is the one where you shoot photons one at a time at a screen with two slits in it. And then you look at where the photon ends up on a second screen behind it. And what you find is that there are certain places where the photon never likes to appear. Okay, now, by itself, that, you know, wouldn't be such a big deal. You could, you know, make up all kinds of, theories that could explain that. When you rerun the experiment with the same initial conditions, then the photon can land in a different place each time. So nature is probabilistic. And people make a huge deal about that, you know, Einstein didn't like that God plays dice and blah, blah, blah. But that by itself is also not the big deal, right? If that was all that there was to it, then we could imagine that each photon has a tiny little ID tag that we simply can't see. And that, you know, somehow secretly determines, am I a photon that will go left or am I one that will go right? Right. But here is the part that is really the staggering one, I think, that, so we had these two slits, right? Now, if I close one of the slits, then the places where the photon previously could not appear, now it can appear in those places, okay? Mm. So in other words, by decreasing the number of paths that a particle can take to get somewhere, I can increase the chance that it gets there, okay? And, so basically, over a few decades from like 1900 until 1926 or so, physicists found more and more phenomena that were like that, you know, that they could not explain until finally they came up with this mathematical framework that made some kind of sense of all of it. And what that framework says is that for each possible way that the world could evolve, or, let's say for each possible path that a photon could take, each slit that it could pass through, you don't only have to assign a probability that it will do that, right? I mean, we use probabilities all the time, even before quantum mechanics, right? You might say, there's a 30% chance of rain, a 30% chance that a particle will go this way. You would never say a negative 30% chance, though, right? That would just be nonsense,
right?
Okay, but what quantum mechanics says is that each possible path actually gets a number called an amplitude, which can be positive or negative. In fact, it can even be a complex number, okay? And now the rule is if you want to know the probability that something will happen, will you take the squared absolute value of its amplitude, okay? So, something that has an amplitude of zero will never happen, right? And now, crucially, the amplitude for something to happen is the sum of the amplitudes for all of the different ways that it could have happened, okay? And so, for example, the explanation for this two-slit behavior is that if the photon can reach a certain spot by taking one path with a positive amplitude, but another path with a negative amplitude, then those two contributions can interfere destructively and cancel each other out. So that the total amplitude is zero, and then that thing never happens, right? If I close one of the slits, then the amplitude is positive or negative, and so now the thing can happen, okay? Now, this is kind of the one trick of quantum mechanics, right? Everything else you've ever heard about the weirdness of the quantum world is this thing, this replacement of probabilities by these complex numbers, these amplitudes, but repeated over and over again, okay? And in particular, a quantum computer would be sort of a massive application of this sort of amplitude behavior of nature. So now a key point about these amplitudes that was recognized from the very beginning, from like Schrodinger's paper in 1926, is that if I have a bunch of particles, like let's say 100 of them, and they can interact with each other, then it's not enough to write down, say, the amplitudes for the first particle to be in all the possible places that it could be, the amplitudes for the second particle to be in all the possible places, and so on. No, you need to write down the amplitudes for all of the combined ways that all of the particles could be. Okay, so to understand what that means, imagine that we had 1,000 particles that could each be in one of two states. You could call them spin up or spin down, okay, which is just some property of a particle that you can see when you look at it.
Sure.
In quantum computing, we prefer to call that a quantum bit or a qubit. That is, like a bit that can be 0, 1, or it can have some amplitude for being 0 and some amplitude for being 1, which we would call a superposition of the 0 and 1 states. Okay, now the key point is that if I have, let's say, 1,000 of these quantum bits, these qubits, now I need an amplitude for all 2^1,000th power possible configurations of all 1,000 bits. Okay, there's an amplitude for all of them to be 0, there's an amplitude for them to be 0, 1, 0, 1, 0, 1, and so forth. There's an amplitude for them to spell out a line of Shakespeare, okay, and so on. So, you know, with just 1,000 particles, that's already more amplitudes than you could write down in the entire observable universe, okay? And yet, you know, if you can get them to interfere with each other, you know, in the quantum mechanical way, then somehow they all contribute to, you know, affecting the probabilities of which outcomes you do see when you look at your particles. Okay, and so you know, chemists and physicists actually knew about this exponentiality for a long time. They knew about it mostly as a practical problem, right? If you're trying to simulate quantum mechanics with a conventional computer, for example, to learn about the rate of some chemical reaction or something like that, right? This exponential blow up is a problem, right? The size of the what's called the wave function, right? Or the list of amplitudes that you've got to keep track of, you know, could double or more than double with each additional particle that you add. Okay, and so, you know, outside of some special cases, it becomes, you know, just intractable to understand what complicated molecules are doing. You know, and you can only try to get a toehold with, you know, some of, you know, the biggest supercomputers that now exist. Okay, so it was in the early 80s that a few physicists, you know, most famously Richard Feynman and David Deutsch, had the idea, well, you know, if nature is giving us this computational lemon, then why don't we make lemonade out of it, right? So why don't we build a computer that itself would be made of qubits, you know, that could, that itself would have an exponential number of these amplitudes that could interfere with each other. You know, of course, they then faced the question, well, you know, supposing that you built such a computer, which they called a quantum computer, what would it be good for? You know, and at that time, they really only had one answer to that question, which was it would be good for simulating quantum mechanics itself, right? Yeah. That is, by the way, still by far the most important application of quantum computers, I think, if and when they become truly practical. You know, there's an enormous number of, you know, engineering problems, material science, condensed matter physics, and so on, where, you know, if you had a universal programmable simulator for quantum mechanics, you know, that would really help. But what really made people interested in quantum computing, what really started it as a field, was a further discovery in the mid-1990s. And this is that if someone built a truly scalable, you know, programmable quantum computer, meaning, you know, with millions of qubits, for example, then you could use it to do more than simulate quantum mechanics. You could use it to solve even certain completely classical problems that, as far as we know today, seem to be exponentially hard for classical computers. Now, the most famous example of that is finding the prime factors of enormous numbers, okay? Which, you know, why do we care about that? Well, that happens to be the problem that most of the encryption that currently protects the internet is based on, right?
Right.
Factoring and a few other problems in number theory, which, as it turns out, would also be solvable with a quantum computer.
So because I had mentioned the email I sent to you, done some like small, I was basically like a code monkey for this professor and grad student on a D-Wave quantum computer. And the way the professor described it was that these sorts of like being able to break encryption, the race to get to quantum supremacy was similar to the race for a nuclear bomb, in that whoever got there first would have this enormous power that...
Sorry, you cut out.
Okay. I was saying that the professor had said
The race for nuclear energy. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, do you feel like that's at all comparable? Is that an exaggeration?
I've certainly used that analogy. I mean, that is, you know, an analogy that could be made. I mean, the similarities are that, you know, you have the laws of physics, you know, predicting that something is possible. right? Something that involves an exponential growth, by the way, right? In one case of, you know, fissioning particles, and in the other case of amplitudes. That prediction seems absurd to some people, but, you know, in some sense, you know, if the prediction were wrong, then ironically, that would be the more surprising thing, right? Because, you know, you're just taking the currently known physics for granted when you make the prediction that this is possible. For it to be wrong, something new has to happen in physics. Now, you know, in both cases, you know, just because something is possible, you know, tells you nothing about how soon it is going to be achieved, right? And I feel like this is an error that people constantly slip into, right? They think if you say that something is possible, they translate that as it must be possible in a few years. And if you, you know, explain, you know, it's not going to happen in a few years, then they translate that as it's impossible, right? But, you know, there is a third category. I mean, you know, other analogies that people make here, you know, powered flight. I mean, people realized, you know, that that could be possible for hundreds of years before the Wright brothers, right? You know, I mean, classical computing, you know, you had Charles Babbage, you know, more than a century before the invention of the transistor, you know, that really made the idea practical. You know, now what was striking about the case of nuclear fission was just how fast it happened in that case, right? That, you know, Szilard, you know, had the idea in 1933, and then, you know, the bombs were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki 12 years later, right? And, you know, and I think, you know, almost no physicists in the 1930s would have predicted that, right? There's a famous story of Niels Bohr, where he said, you know, sure, in principle, you could build a fission bomb, but in practice, it will never happen because you would have to convert a whole country into a uranium enrichment factory. Okay, and then, you know, in like 1942 or so, he finally was able to see, or three, he was able to see the Manhattan Project. And he said, well, I see that that's exactly what you've done, right?
Yeah.
So you know, and it's similar with quantum computers, right? People constantly ask me to try to forecast when we'll have useful quantum computers. And I always try to dance around that question and avoid answering it, right? I mean, you know, I read the news these days and, you know, I don't even know how much longer civilization will last for, right?
Yeah.
But I mean, you know, there are so many uncertainties, right? But, you know, I mean, at some point these things become a question of, you know, how badly do people want this? You know, are they willing to spend like hundreds of billions of dollars to make it happen? You know, do they have the organization to follow through with that? Right. You know, and when it gets down to that kind of question, you know, it could be 5 years and it could be 50 years.
One of the things when you were talking earlier about the sort of like the weirdness and the counterintuitive aspect of quantum mechanics.
Yeah.
I had talked to Chomsky on this podcast, and he was speaking as a cognitive scientist, where he was saying that human brains, generally speaking, sort of they're good at understanding determinism, like, you know, billiard balls, things hitting one another, and randomness, things just, you know, throw the dice. But things like free will and consciousness don't seem to abide by those sorts of principles. Do you think that quantum mechanics can sort of fill the gap in our reasoning there, or is that?
Well, there have been speculations about that, you know, since like before the ink was dry on, you know, Schrodinger's paper, right? People have been talking about, you know, could quantum mechanics help to explain consciousness or free will or whatever, you know, since there was quantum mechanics. You know, there are a few problems that sort of, those are such enormous mysteries, you know, and quantum mechanics is such an enormous thing that we know about the architecture of the world that I don't dismiss the possibility that they have something to do with each other, right? I don't, okay? But having said that, any attempt to relate them, you know, has some very huge obstacles to overcome, you know, that I think people ought to be better aware of, right? The first, you know, obstacle is that, you know, quantum mechanics is, you could say in a broad sense, is still a mechanistic theory, right? like in the sense that if you know the state, the initial state of a system, you know, of a quantum system, and if you know the laws governing the evolution, so you, then you know completely how this list of amplitudes is going to evolve. And that means that you can exactly predict, not necessarily the outcome of the experiment, but you could predict the probability distribution over the possible outcomes. Okay, so you could say the only thing that is left for free will to do, you know, if the initial state were entirely known, you know, and if the evolution were entirely known, then the only thing that would be left would be like one spin of a roulette wheel, right? Mm-hmm. Just to, you know, select, you know, an outcome from this probability distribution, right? I mean, like think about radioactive atoms, right? Each one has a half-life, which means we don't know exactly when it will decay. You know, we know exactly what is the probability distribution over decay times, right? So if you have a whole sample of, you know, uranium atoms or whatever, then you know almost exactly what fraction of them will have decayed by such and such a time, right? Now, you know, would we say that each individual uranium atom has free will? You know, I mean, that would just seem like a strange use of language, right? Yeah. And so then, you know, you could say, well, if that would be strange for the uranium atom, then you know, one has to articulate, then how is the brain different from that, right? Now I have a long essay that I wrote 7 years ago called The Ghost in the Quantum Turing Machine, where I try to, you know, sketch out a view where quantum mechanics is important to these questions, but what's really important about it is not just the randomness. What's important is sort of the unknowability of the initial state, right? So, you know, a further property of quantum mechanics, and this is not something that is shared by just classical randomness, okay, is the property that you cannot exactly learn the state of a system, you know, even just an atom, without inalterably changing the state. Okay, you know, you're measuring the state, you know, forces it to make up its mind, to sort of collapse, to sort of lose its superposition character. You know, it's no longer this list of amplitudes. Now it's just peaked at one outcome because you caused this atom to interact with its environment, with, you know, with the larger world. And so, you know, you could say, you know, so one question that people have debated for a long time in the philosophy of mind, you know, is the question, could you make a perfect replica of a person? Or let's say, you know, would you agree to have yourself teleported to Mars, you know, by a machine that would just scan your brain, you know, email all of the information to Mars, you know, and then a perfect copy of you would be reconstituted on Mars. And then let's say the original copy would be painlessly euthanized, right? Would you agree to that, right? I mean, you know, if it's a perfect, on the one hand, it's a perfect copy, so it seems like it should be no different from just getting on a bus and, you know, getting on a spaceship and going somewhere. You know, on the other hand, you know, I think, you know, I'm not alone in feeling unease, right, about that procedure. And what quantum mechanics said, actually suggests is that, you know, depending on how much you know, of the microscopic detail, you know, of a person's brain you would have to capture to make a good enough copy of it, you know, it might or might not be possible in principle to actually do what I just said, to, you know, to transcribe the state of a brain as information. It might require making measurements that would just necessarily alter that brain, okay? So you could, you know, in physical systems in quantum mechanics have a sort of privacy to them, you know, that they don't have in classical physics. You know, now it's not obvious that that has anything to do with these mysteries, because, you know, it could be, for example, that, you know, you can perfectly well predict someone's behavior in practice by just scanning the more macroscopic parts of their brain. Like, you know, how are the neurons wired together? are they firing or not firing? And that, you know, in the far future, some nanorobots could do that, you know, without doing much damage to the brain at all, right? That's possible, but, you know, quantum mechanics opens up the possibility that there could be a limit there, a limit to copyability coming from physics. So I did try to explore what that means. You know, maybe I should add, you know, none of this really touches on, you know, the hard problem of consciousness, right? The problem of, like, why does it feel like anything to be a brain, right? You know, why aren't we just, you know, complicated computers made of meat? Or you know, alternatively, could it feel like something to be a computer program? You know, and those are questions that I think of as, like, vertiginous, like questions that, you know, it's not clear how any reasoning or any empirical science ever gets a toehold on those sorts of questions. And it doesn't even seem to matter much if the world is classical or quantum. Like, you could say, you know, why should some people say, oh, well, you know, if the brain is quantum, then that will somehow explain consciousness, you know, but why, right? Why would a quantum mechanical brain, you know, feel like anything, you know, to be any more than a classical brain?
Yeah, and that kind of that leads into something, a post I had seen you had written about integrated information theory, which sort of purports to explain, you know, be able to calculate consciousness in any physical system. And you made a good point where you're like, okay, any scientific theory you could invent to explain consciousness still doesn't account for the fact that I could imagine some zombie that has all those physical characteristics and yet doesn't feel the same feeling of consciousness that we do.
That's right.
So
that's I mean,
yeah.
I wasn't saying anything original there. I mean, you know, Chalmers and, you know, and hundreds of philosophers before him have made the same point, right? But I mean, you know, with regard to integrated information theory, you know, I was making a much more specific point, you know, in that post, right? I was saying, you know, so that is a proposed theory that tries to, you know, if not explain consciousness, then at least tell you how much consciousness, you know, is present in any physical system. Or, you know, be able to tell you, is a given system conscious or not, just, you know, as a function of how it's organized. And the argument that I was making in the post that you mentioned is that integrated information theory just manifestly fails, even at that limited task, right? And the way that I did that was, the way I argued that was by reductio ad absurdum, right? Or by counterexample. Okay, I constructed examples of systems that, you know, seem to me plainly not conscious, you know, or rather, you know, if they are conscious, then so is a bag of potato chips, you know, and so is absolutely anything, right?
But they would claim that it is, though.
What?
So I talked to Christoph Koch about this, and he would say that, yeah, like a bag of peanuts would be on some level conscious. Like a very minimal amount.
Well, right. But But the problem is that according to the, you know, so if IIT predicted that it was a minimal amount, that would be okay. But we can construct systems that seem, you know, as plainly dumb as a bag of peanuts, but whose integrated information is enormously greater than the human brain's is. Okay. So that is the problem. Okay. Yeah. And that is the reason why this integrated information is just not a good measure that sort of captures what I think what anyone meant prior to this theory by words like consciousness, right? I mean, you know, Giulio Tononi, who's the founder of IID, you know, responded to my post, you know, wrote a whole essay about it. His response was just to bite the bullet and say, yeah, if you constructed these systems, is like, you know, like a gigantic mess, a grid, just, you know, compute some error correcting code or something like that, then yeah, that would have more consciousness than a person. And, you know, that might be unpalatable, but that's just what the theory says. So, you know, science is not about confirming the obvious. We should just go along with that non-obvious conclusion, right? But, you know, I mean, to me, the problem with that just seems staggeringly obvious. Like, if you have a theory that has made correct predictions about some things, you know, and you could check them, right? Like, you know, if you had a theory that, you know, could measure the temperature of ice and of boiling water and tell you that the boiling water is hotter, right? Then maybe you trust that theory, you know, even about realms far from your experience, like to tell you about the temperature of the sun or something like that, okay? But integrated information theory, you know, the in some sense, the only way we have to test it, you know, at present is, does it give the answers that, you know, we would hope that it would give for things like the human brain, for the bag of peanuts, for, you know, a rabbit, for a frog, you know, for cases where we feel like we have some prior intuition about how much consciousness is there. If it gets those cases wrong, then what is there for it to get right? You know, what grounds do we have for believing the theory in the first place?
That's interesting, because when I talked to Christoph Koch about it, he said that because that he would make a difference between artificial and natural systems, and the example you gave of a giant grid of error correcting code would sort of fall outside of the domain of IIT because it's in some sense artificial. Do you think that's
that is emphatically not Tononi's position? Okay, so
right.
The founder of IIT emphatically disagrees with that. He says, no, this is a theory for telling you whether an arbitrary physical system is conscious or not. You know, and in some sense, you know, if you had to restrict the scope of the theory and say, well, you know, in those cases where it gives an absurd result, it just doesn't apply to those cases. Well, then, you know, in some sense, what is the point of the theory, right? Yeah. We already knew that, you know, we already had the idea that you know, that our brains are conscious, you know, that within our brains, let's say the, you know, cerebral cortex, you know, seems to be the seat of consciousness, you know, much more so than, you know, the cerebellum or whatever. You know, we already had the idea that, you know, that a brick wall is not conscious, or that, you know, a uniform grid of exclusive door gates is not conscious. What's wanted is a theory that will explain all of these facts from some deeper principle.
Yeah.
Right. What's wanted is not just right. Yeah.
No, I mean, I fair enough. I agree. But the the slightly different topic. Much different topic. What is your position on like the many worlds theory, that, you know, there's some parallel universe where we're having this exact same conversation, but maybe you adjusted your glasses a mm-hmm. little differently or something like that. Do you buy that?
I think that, you know, it is a way of talking about quantum mechanics. And what surprises a lot of people is that it's actually an extremely conservative way of talking about quantum mechanics, right? People think that it sounds radical and science fiction-y, you know, and it was actually, you know, bitterly opposed by the sort of founders of quantum mechanics, who basically just, you know, had wanted to say, look, you know, there is the microscopic quantum world, and then, you know, there is our macroscopic world that obeys classical physics, and you have to draw a line between them somewhere. And, you know, what explains, you know, why there is that line, or how there could be that line? Well, you're just not supposed to talk about that, right? You know, if you keep asking about that, that just shows that you're mired in the old way of thinking and you don't understand quantum mechanics, right? So, I mean, you know, that was a way of, you know, that's called the Copenhagen point of view, you know, and there's, you know, of course, many, many, many more words put on it than that. But, you know, I think that that's basically what it boils down to. I've called it shut up and calculate, except without shutting up, right? And, you know, I think that that was guaranteed not to satisfy people forever. You know, people don't just want to know, how do I use this theory to predict the probability that I'll see something? They want to know, what is the world like, you know, or what is the state of the world? You know, what kind of object is it? And, you know, and you and me and everyone else, we should just be some some patterns, you know, that exist in a state of the world, right? We don't want the laws of physics to be all about us, about, you know, what predictions we make. You know, we want it to actually describe a real universe that was here before us and that will continue to be here after we're gone. Now, here's what I would say. I would say, if you believe in what I just said, which is, you know, the philosophers would call realism, right? So if you're a realist about, you know, the state of the physical universe, and also if you think that quantum mechanics is exactly true, so, you know, quantum mechanics is not just an approximation to some future theory, you know, but it is literally true. You know, the Schrodinger equation that governs the linear evolution of the amplitudes is an exactly true equation. Secondly, you believe that. And thirdly, you believe that we don't get to add any additional ingredient to quantum mechanics. So we don't get to add a new ingredient that says, you know, that picks out this world as the real world and says that the other world, the world where I adjusted my glasses differently, is just some ghost town where, you know, no one experiences anything, right? So with those three assumptions, then I think many worlds is inevitable, right?
Okay.
Then that is just where you're led, okay? So, you know, I feel like, you know, my personal opinion is exhausted by sort of by clearly laying out what is the decision tree, right? Yeah. And you can disagree with many worlds, but then you've got to disagree with one of those three assumptions, either the exact truth of quantum mechanics or realism or the completeness of quantum mechanics.
Okay, so I want to understand exactly how the quantum mechanics entails many worlds.
I didn't say that it does. I said that if you want to be a realist about quantum mechanics and if you want to not add any extra ingredients to quantum mechanics. Okay. So here, but I can explain how, you know, how with those assumptions that it entails it. Okay. So the basic idea is, well, you know, we talked before about amplitudes giving rise to probabilities, right? So, you know, if I look at a screen to see where the photon landed, then, you know, I will see that it landed on a particular spot with probability that goes like the squared absolute value of the amplitude for it to land at that spot, okay? Now, you know, in some sense, the most mysterious part of quantum mechanics is that very last step. How do the amplitudes become probabilities, right? So, you know, I started out with this superposition, you know, where it was not definitely in any one of the places, it just had an amplitude for being in each place. And then after I looked, then I saw it definitely in one of them. And, you know, in each one with an appropriate probability. Okay, so how did that happen? You know, and it seems like, you know, it can't possibly be that I looked, right? Because, you know, or that a conscious being looked, right? Because, you know, in fact, you know, it doesn't have to be a conscious being that looked in the following sense. If the information about where the photon was got recorded in the state of the external environment in any way whatsoever, so like if it leaked into the other radiation in the room or the air molecules or, you know, the vibrational modes of the screen, you know, if the information about where the photon was has leaked out in any way, then the effect on the photon will be exactly as if the photon had been measured. Okay, so then, you know, once you want, you know, and you can do experiments where you, you know, directly confirm that, right? Where you see that when the state of your quantum system becomes entangled with the larger environment, then it is as if that system has been measured. Okay, that's called decoherence, you know, the loss of the coherence of a quantum state. Okay, and this is sort of is now understood to be absolutely central to the story of how quantum mechanics gives rise to the appearance of a classical world, right? Like, we never see cats in superpositions of alive and dead states, right? Or, you know, we never see balls in superpositions of thrown and not being thrown. Okay, that's not because it's impossible in principle. That's simply because cats and balls are such large objects that are so tightly coupled to their environments that, you know, the instant that, like, you try to put a ball into a superposition of, you know, throwing it and not throwing it, you know, the information about what you had done would have leaked out. Okay, it's kind of like, you know, like imagine, you know, you have some embarrassing secret and people start posting it on Twitter, right? Once they start tweeting it and retweeting it, then, you know, you're never going to get it back in the bag, right? And this is why, you know, superpositions are really, really hard to maintain, you know, on anything close to the scale of everyday life. Incidentally, you know, this decoherence is also why it is so hard to build a quantum computer, because then, you know, you need to have millions or billions of qubits and keep them almost perfectly isolated from their environment so that they don't lose their coherence, right? That's really hard. Okay, but once you understand this decoherence, then you can say, well, let's suppose that I looked at a situation where you are looking at a photon, okay? You are making a measurement of a quantum state, but now I could decide to treat not only the photon, but you by the rules of quantum mechanics, okay? After all, you know, you're just a big collection of atoms, right? And each of those atoms should be governed by the same laws of quantum mechanics that govern the particle that you're measuring, right? And when we try to do that, the result that we get, you know, is, I would say, it's as unequivocal as it is weird, right? The result is that, you know, we start with a state where you are measuring, let's say, the particle to see whether it, was horizontally or vertically polarized or something like that, and you don't know which it is. Now we end, and in fact it was in a superposition of the two states, okay? And we end with a quantum superposition state where there is some amplitude that the particle is horizontally polarized and you have perceived it as being horizontally polarized, right? So your measuring device has recorded that, you know, your brain has registered the information and so on. The information is leaked into the air molecules in the room. And then there is also amplitude on a state where the particle is vertically polarized and where you've perceived it as being vertically polarized, right? And there is nothing in the Schrodinger equation, which is sort of the equation that governs how the amplitudes evolve, that's going to make one of those two branches go away, right? They're both still going to be there forever. Once they've become sort of macroscopically distinct, you know, then in practice, they're never again going to interact with each other, okay? So they'll be separate, you know, forevermore, or at least until the entire universe reaches its heat death. Okay, and that's not an assumption, that's just a prediction that you get from quantum mechanics. The reason why you would have to add something extra to this picture is if you believe that is just unacceptable, and you know physics has to deliver for us one macroscopic world, you know, one world of experience. Well, in that case, you would need to add some extra ingredient that would get rid of one of the outcomes. Okay, and now, you know, it is far from impossible that such an extra ingredient will exist, right? And, you know, and I mean, some views about what it would be would even make empirical predictions that, you know, in principle could someday be tested, right? So I don't rule that possibility out. I'm just explaining to you why, you know, in some sense, many worlds is the minimalist option, ironically.
So the only thing I'm having trouble understanding is the idea that because these, and correct me if I'm misunderstanding this, mm-hmm. at all,
yeah.
Because these two possibilities, in this case of me observing a certain, like a photon, have a given amplitude, have like a non-zero probability, or, you know, non-zero probability, that they must, in some sense, that probability must, if not in this universe, be realized, in some other universe be realized. Is that what you're saying?
Okay. Yeah. Okay. But what's really crucial here is that it's not a probability. It is an amplitude.
Okay.
Okay. Amplitudes are different from probabilities. Amplitudes are complex numbers. Okay. They can be positive or negative. You know, they have a phase to them. And why is that so important? Well, because when we have a superposition, that we have, you know, not just, you know, I mean, if all we knew was, right, there's some probability that the photon goes this way and there's some probability that it goes that way, then it is always open to us to just say, really, it went one way or the other, right? Really, there's some way that it went, but it's just our ignorance, you know, that prevents us from saying which way, and we encode our ignorance in this language of probabilities. Okay, when it's a superposition, when it's amplitudes, you don't have that option. Okay, and why don't you have that option? Well, because we in principle, and for small enough quantum systems, also in practice, we can do an experiment where we bring the two branches together and we cause them to interfere with each other. Okay, so you can, you know. If you have a particle, let's say, that's in an equal superposition of, you know, going through a left slit and going through a right slit, if anyone says, well, really, it went through one slit or the other one, you just don't know which one it went through. And so you're just using this whole fancy language of, you know, superposition to just say that you don't know. You can prove that that person is wrong.
Right.
Okay. You can empirically prove that they're wrong. And the way that you do it is by interfering the two paths, right? You show that in some sense, you know, the laws, you know, the universe must have known something about both of them, right? Was somehow keeping track of the state of both of them. Okay. So now you could say that fine, there's that superposition, but in addition to the superposition, on top of it, you know, there is one possibility that is sort of the real one, the ontologically real one. That is exactly what Bohmian mechanics says, right? So Bohmian mechanics is a third position in, you know, the interpretation of quantum mechanics, different from Copenhagen, also different from many worlds, okay? Bohmian mechanics says, yes, there is this whole superposition, this whole, including over different versions of us and so on, just like many worlds would say. But then the Bohmians would add to it, but, you know, it is only one of the outcomes that is really experienced and, you know, or that is sort of ontologically real. And all of the other ones, they're just ghost towns, right? They're there in the equation, but they're not, you know, but they're somehow not as real, not as experienced. Okay. But then there's, you know, even the Bohmians, they still have to say that those other branches are there in the equation, because if they didn't say that, then they wouldn't get the right prediction.
Okay, so that's that makes sense, I suppose, because my gut feeling is that it's hard to accept this. I suppose part of that is because it makes me feel small.
You're completely right that it's hard to accept. You're completely right. And look, you know, I have friends who think that, you know, anyone who disagrees with, you know, the many worlds interpretation just thereby proves their irrationality and that they can't be taken seriously about anything else. Right? I am very moderate compared to that, let's say, right?
Yeah.
I think that, you know, these are questions where, you know, it is totally unclear how we're going to resolve them empirically, and, but by construction, we have all these different views that lead to exactly the same predictions for all the experiments that we can do. So, you know, it's not surprising that it's going to eventually come down to questions like, what do you think that a scientific theory should do for you, right? Is it supposed to describe an objective state of the whole universe, you know, or is it supposed to only describe your experience? You know, in the latter case, you could certainly reject many worlds, right? That's one way to reject it, just by becoming an instrumentalist about physics, right? I mean, another way to reject it is, look, you could say, it could be that, like every other theory in the history of physics, quantum mechanics will someday be superseded by something else, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, if quantum mechanics were to be superseded, you know, then whatever supersedes it might give a definite criterion for when a superposition collapses, you know, when it resolves into a single state. And, you know, as soon as we had a theory like that, well, then poof, all of the many worlds would be gone, right? All the worlds would be gone except for our world, you know, and some, you could say, some very, very nearby ones, you know, that sort of produce the interference patterns that we see. So at that point, you know, the question becomes, well, like, how, you know, just how much should we believe in the exact truth of quantum mechanics? But I think when quantum mechanics was first discovered in the 20s, you know, people really had the impression that this was provisional, right? That this could easily be superseded by something else. But by now, it's been around for almost 100 years without, you know, a single change, you know, to the fundamentals since Schrodinger wrote down his equation in 1926. Okay, and by now, you know, we have tested it on, you know, vastly bigger scales than they were able to back then, right? People can do the double slit experiment, not just with photons or with electrons, but with, molecules that have thousands of atoms in them. Okay, so not quite big enough to see with the naked eye, but, you know, much, much bigger things. I mean, there is, you know, a serious prospect that in our lifetimes, people will be able to create superposition states of, let's say, a virus, or a biological, things like that. Okay, so a quantum computer, even you could, you know, maybe even more in some ways, would force on us the question, well, you know, where is the cut? You know, if quantum mechanics can extend all the way up to the scale of a programmable computer that could even have some sophisticated AI program running on it and so forth, well, then why shouldn't it extend all the way up to the scale of our own brains, right? But if it extends to that scale, then how do we get out of the inclusion of many worlds? So there's also just this feature of quantum mechanics that it seems like a very, very rigid theory, because it's really just this generalization of probability. It's this sort of level beneath physics. It seems very, very hard to make the slightest change to quantum mechanics without getting complete nonsense. Okay, and in that way, it is very different from, let's say, general relativity, which, you know, there are lots of ways to modify, or the standard model of, you know, of particle physics, or most other theories in physics. You know, quantum mechanics just seems very, very hard to change. But, you know, maybe someday something will be discovered beyond it. Maybe it's just our lack of imagination. And of course, if something is found beyond quantum mechanics, then the whole question of many worlds would have to be considered anew.
Well, that's what you said in there about testing this idea of many worlds empirically. I mean, how would you even, I mean, do people know if there are even such a thing as parallel universes at all?
That's exactly what we're talking about, right? I mean, the issue is, quantum mechanics says that, anytime you have two different possible ways that a system could be, you can have a linear combination of those two ways, you know, a superposition of them. And you can also, you know, do an experiment where you see interference between the two components of that superposition, okay, at least in principle, you know, maybe not in practice. So when people talk, you know, I mean, it is not, I should say, it is totally unclear whether there's any way, even in principle, to test the many worlds interpretation, right? It largely depends on what you even mean by testing something, okay? Because here is the kind of thing that people talk about when they talk about, you know, quote unquote, testing the many worlds interpretation. And then these were like the thoughts that David Deutsch had, 40 years ago or so, that were part of what led him to the idea of a quantum computer in the first place. Okay, so Deutsch said, well, suppose that we could take our entire brains and we could upload them into computers. Okay, so we had, you know, consciousness living in computers. Okay, that's just step one of the experiment. Okay, so yeah, suppose that, of course there would be a question, you know, would these computer programs, even if they perfectly simulated us, would they really be conscious, right? But let's suppose that our language had shifted in such a way that, you know, that no one hesitated to regard such things as conscious. Okay, well, in that case, Deutsch said, in principle, we could take this program and we could put it onto a quantum computer and we could create a superposition over two different conscious states. Or let's say, you know, a state of the computer program that corresponds to a person thinking one thought and a state of the program that corresponds to them thinking another thought. Okay, and then crucially, we could do an interference experiment between those two states so we could prove that both of them were really there. Okay, and at that point, you know, provided that you accepted that this computer was conscious at all, you would have to accept that, yes, you know, this conscious being had been in a superposition of thinking two different thoughts, you know, exactly like the many worlds interpretation said. Mm-hmm. Okay, now, having said that, I hasten to add, you know, the Copenhagen people, right, you know, have, as you might imagine, have a response to this, right? So they say, yeah, you know, if that experiment could be done, you know, we make exactly the same prediction as the many world people for what you would see. Yeah, sure, you would see the interference pattern between the two different states of the person's mind. But then they would say, well, we just talk about it in a completely different way. We say that quantum mechanics is a personal theory, right? It is relative to the user, right? And so if you from the outside were sort of looking at someone else being manipulated in superposition in this way, then, you know, relative to you, you would say that that person was in a superposition, that they had undergone interference. But for the person who was being manipulated in that way, you know, in each state, they would only have, you know, at most one experience, if indeed they experienced anything at all. Okay, and so no one would ever have to talk about themselves being in a superposition state. Okay, but you know, you could say that you know, if this experiment were done, you know, then whether it proves anything, you know, I think, you know, it might well change the way that people talk about these things, right? I mean, because then, you know, you could imagine some far future where it was just a commonplace to take intelligent beings and manipulate them in superposition states. And you know, you might imagine that in such a future that the many worlds interpretation would be a lot more popular.
Speaking of which, what are your thoughts on the simulation theory? Do you take that seriously at all?
Well, not really, but not because I have a good reason to think that it's false, just because I don't see what it buys you, right? I mean, to say that the universe is a simulation, you know, running in a different universe, okay, great. And maybe that universe is a simulation running in a still larger universe and so on infinitely, right? In fact, maybe that entire infinite sequence is a simulation, you know, running in some, you know, infinitely large computer. But, you know, in science, we try to do better than just, you know, constructing towers of speculations, right? We try to say, if this were true, then how would it affect what we experience? Okay, and what, you know, the entire, you know, idea of the universe being a simulation, unless you add anything to it, it is empirically sterile, right? It predicts nothing, you know, and it explains nothing. Okay, that is the issue with it.
Yeah, it kind of reminds me of like when people talk about a belief in God. It's like it's not even falsifiable. Yeah.
That's right. So now if you add something to that belief, if you say God is smiting my enemies, you know, God will answer my prayers, right? Then those are beliefs that you know, have empirical consequences, right? You know, it matters whether those are true or false, okay? But, you know, you could say if God is just an abstract entity that created the universe and then, you know, sat back and did nothing, right? Then, you know, that becomes very hard to distinguish from the simulation hypothesis at that point. And, you know, exactly the same objections of, you know, lack of explanatory power would apply in both cases.
And I've already taken up an hour of your time, so I only have a couple more questions left. But the other sort of pop science thing I wanted to ask you about was like the singularity, where people think that there will be an AI that will be so much more intelligent than all of human intelligence combined that it'll take off like that. How do you feel about that?
I mean, it's certainly not impossible. You know, we don't know anything in the laws of math or physics that would say that the human brain, you know, is the absolute, you know, limit of intelligence that the laws of the physics allow. In fact, it would be kind of shocking if it were, right? And, you know, just like, it took hundreds of years, but eventually, you know, we exceeded, you know, human, we built machines that could exceed humans along all sorts of other dimensions, whether that's, you know, strength, running, you know, doing arithmetic, or now, you know, even, you know, recognizing pictures and, you know, translating from one language to another and, you know, doing more and more of what we formerly thought of as intelligence, right? So, you know, particularly if one agrees that the brain itself is a physical system, you know, governed by the laws of physics, then it becomes very, very hard to explain why we could not someday engineer, you know, a different physical system that would display, you know, a much greater degree of intelligence. Okay, so up to that point, I think that the singularity people are absolutely right. Now, do I regard this as like the most pressing issue facing humanity? No, I mean, in fact, like in some sense, I would be thrilled if, you know, if we survive long enough that, you know, being conquered by AI, you know, it becomes the most pressing threat, right? Yeah. Like, you know, if only we should last that long, right? You know, that, you know, if only we should, you know, survive climate change and, you know, survive the, you know, authoritarianism that seems to be taking over much of the world right now. But having said that, I mean, I think that if you had asked me 10 or 15 years ago, I would have said, you know, this is just really, really far in the future, right? It is so far in the future that it's not even profitable to, you know, be putting that much effort right now into, you know, thinking about how do we prevent AIs from taking over the world, right? It's like someone analogized it to, you know, thinking about, you know, how do we prevent overpopulation on Mars, right? Like, yeah, it might eventually become an issue, but it just, you know, we've got much more immediate issues to worry about, right? And I still think that we have more immediate issues to worry about, but I also think that within the last 10 or 15 years, you know, the possibility of human level AI within our lifetimes has become more real. I mean, the successes of deep learning, you know, in the last decade have been absolutely spectacular. I think, you know, way beyond what many of us predicted was possible and, you know, or would be possible in such a short time, you know, and people try to poo-poo them. But it's like, well, you know, did you predict that, you know, by now, you know, that an AI was going to go from, you know, not being very impressive at Go to just a few months later, you know, destroying the human world champion at Go, right? And then it would do that without any particular knowledge about Go, that it would do that just by playing itself millions of times and teaching itself how to play and sort of ignoring, humanity's like centuries of accumulated knowledge about how to play this game. Like, did you predict that? Did you predict that that there would be this text engine, this GPT-3, right? That can, come, I would say at least with people who don't know what they're looking for, now come very, very close to passing an unrestricted Turing test, right? That can converse with you, that can, write essays, at least as good as like a B or C student, high school student, right? About any topic that you ask it to, and then, have some semblance of coherence, to them. Right? I mean, if you didn't predict those things, then you don't get to say after the fact that it wasn't impressive, right? And what's a little bit scary, you could say, is that these improvements have not come from a new theoretical breakthrough, so much as they've come from just throwing more and more hardware, more and more training data, and more and more computation cycles, with just the same types of algorithms that people already knew about, in the 80s. Okay, and so, but now, the hardware is obviously going to keep, improving, right? Massively, right? The original Moore's law has basically ended now. Okay, but the number of cores, the number of parallel processors, the amount of memory you have, those are still on an exponential trajectory. And if you look at just the raw numbers, in let's say the GPT-3 model, right? There is not as much information there as there is in the human brain. Right now, there's maybe as much as there is in some, very small mammal's brain. Okay, but in 5 years, there will be as much there as there is in the human brain. So what happens then? My guess would be that these methods are going to hit diminishing returns at some point, and that, there will be some further deep ideas that are needed to get all the way to human level intelligence. But I mostly just believe that because it would just seem too absurd if it were otherwise, right? And one has to admit that so far we have not yet seen that point of diminishing returns. So far, the deep learning methods just do better and better the more hardware you run them with.
The last thing I wanted to ask you about is I had heard that you had interned at Bell Labs back in the 90s. Yeah. For people who are listening who don't know, Bell Labs for many years was an incredible fountain of research. And you were there as a teenager. Like, what was that like?
I think that was a transformative experience in my life. I had been very unhappy in high school. I was lucky enough to be able to start college early through this program called the Clarkson School in upstate New York. So I was already in college then by the time that I went to Bell Labs.
High school? Sorry to interrupt. Typical.
I think a lot of the same reasons that one wouldn't like being in prison.
Fair enough.
There were some great teachers. There were some, great friends, but, ultimately, you are in an environment, in a very artificial environment where, you are forced to,
a bell rings and you go to the next class.
You need a hall pass to walk around. There is a great deal of bullying. There was a great deal of boredom that one has to put up with. I knew that I liked programming and I liked math, and I was very lucky to sort of get to a place where I could, pursue the things that interested me. And then to get from that sort of high school environment to, within the space of a year or two to Bell Labs, I mean, that was incredible for me. I was there in some of the last years that Bell Labs was really a thriving entity. It's incredibly sad that, it was, I guess a casualty of deregulation, and then, it doesn't exist in anything like the form that it did anymore. But I spent one summer there working on, some statistical software. It had nothing to do with quantum computing, but my boss said, you're interested in quantum computing, go read up on it. Sure, that's great. And I spent, a month doing that. And then I found out that Lob Grover, who was the discoverer of one of the most famous quantum algorithms called Grover's algorithm, actually worked in the same building at Bell Labs.
Wow.
So I went and I talked to him. I had a bunch of ideas for improving Grover's algorithm, which were complete nonsense. They, completely didn't work. But Lob Grover was nice enough to say, well, why don't you come back and work for me next summer? And so I did that. And then I met, other students who were also working for Lob, like one of whom had come from Berkeley, which at that point was like the center of the world for research in quantum computing theory. So then I found out what was going on in that area, and I still wasn't sure that if I could make any original contribution to that area. In fact, I spent that whole summer working on a certain problem that I couldn't solve, and that fall was then solved by one of the students from Berkeley. Okay, uh-huh. And so then I said, with just a completely new method, completely different from anything that I had been thinking about. But just seeing that, to be beaten, so fair and square, right? Or so fairly. I mean, I think it made a really big impression on me. It was like, wow, these people in Berkeley, they really know a lot that I don't know. And I really want to go there to learn whatever it is that they know. And, I actually started in Berkeley doing AI, because it was the AI people who recruited me there, so I, again, in a different branch of the quantum multiverse, I'm probably still an AI person. But within a year, I had sort of fallen in with the quantum computing crowd, which was sort of where my heart had been. And I guess it stayed interesting enough that 20 years later, I'm still there.
That's amazing, though, that you worked on that problem all summer, then someone else solves it, and then you've gone on to do all the great things you've done. I mean, I think it's definitely a beacon of hope to a lot of younger people, especially, listening to that is inspirational. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I was going to say, if you discover something and it turns out to have been already discovered, I mean, this is a good sign, right? If it was already something that was already discovered, 10 years ago, well, great. Well, then, maybe next time you'll, discover something that was only discovered 2 years ago, right? And then, maybe you'll only, and then eventually you'll discover something that no one has discovered yet, right? So, and certainly if someone else solves a problem that you can't solve, right, there is an opportunity to learn something.
All right, let's wrap this up.
Yeah.
Scott, thank you very much for talking.
Sure. Absolutely.
I really enjoyed this. You're welcome back anytime. And is there anything you want to plug before you head out?
No.
Okay. All right, great. Thank you very much.
All right.
Take care.
All right, take care, Duncan. Okay, bye-bye.
Thank you to Scott Aronson, and thank you for listening to Dunk Tank. I'm Duncan Gammy. See you next time.